Ross Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. Colorado and Washington are the first states to legalize the sale and possession of marijuana for recreational use. 18 states, including New Jersey and Delaware and Washington, D.C., had previously legalized medical marijuana. Our guest Daniel Okrent wrote an op-ed after the November election drawing some striking parallels between prohibition and the current war on drugs. Okrent is the author of the bestseller Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition, which is now out in paperback. He's also the curator of an exhibit at the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia about prohibition called American Spirits, and it runs through April 2013. Daniel Okrent is a former book and magazine editor, the first public editor of the New York Times, the author of several other books, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
So what is the significance of what Washington and Colorado did?
Well, I think it's the first sign that the 42-year losing war on drugs, that it's time for withdrawal, apparently. In California in 2010, a measure to legalize recreational marijuana came fairly close to passing, but it was a 53-47%. And just in 2 years that it's moved to a point where it can get electoral majorities is really a sign that the world is changing, I think, on this issue.
What's interesting is because it's not so long ago, there was the get tough on drug laws, people being put into prison for small amounts of drugs. There was the cocaine versus crack cocaine criminalization. I mean, it's interesting that something has changed.
Well, this is a story of American history. We think that we are a certain people who believe certain things, and then we find as the world around us changes that we have to adapt to it. Mm-hmm. Certainly was the story of Prohibition very clearly, that something like this could come in after Americans had been drinking freely for 150 years, and then it could go out as well. I think that it's really probably part of a larger awareness of two things. One, that it's very difficult for government to get people to not do what people want to do. And then secondarily, and this connects directly to Prohibition, I'm sure we'll talk about this shortly, states are in desperate need of tax revenue.
Yes.
And both of these measures call for regulation and a great deal of taxing by the state. Nobody seems to want to pay taxes any longer, so the response is, well, let's create user taxes. Let's charge people to get into the national parks. Let's charge people to smoke marijuana.
Well, what's interesting, I was looking at an organization called the Marijuana Majority, and there's Pat Robertson's picture, there's David Koch, there's Cory Booker. It is such an interesting bipartisan, if I can say, group of people that are in support of this organization.
Well, it stretches from the libertarian right to the anti-authoritarian left, and this, too, was the case in Prohibition. The original Prohibition coalition that put Prohibition into the Constitution reached on the right from the Ku Klux Klan, which saw it as a means of combating the political influence of the immigrants in the big cities. Many of the big city political machines in the Northeast were controlled by Irish and Italian immigrants, and the nativists in the South and the Midwest thought that by fighting against liquor, they could in some ways disarm the immigrants. Through the middle to the Progressive Party, the 17 of the 18 members of the Progressive Party in Congress voted for Prohibition. And then at the far left, the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies, the most radical labor organization in American history. They were for Prohibition because they thought that they argued that liquor was a weapon being used by the plutocratic classes to keep the working man down.
But we're also, I think, acknowledging the fact that many people smoke marijuana in this country.
Right. There's a difference between saying it's against the law and people actually following the law. As was said often during Prohibition, it was really the perfect situation. The dries had their law and the wets had their liquor. And I think that that's been the case with the drug laws here. If I might, I would like to say that I have no political personal brief for marijuana. I didn't like the stuff myself. I was very upset when my kids were smoking it when they're now grown, when they were teenagers. I don't think it's adds a lot to our culture. But I also think that I'm not in favor of prostitution, but it's impossible to make these things illegal effectively. We've learned from the beginning of the species, every society has tried to outlaw prostitution, but people, if they want something and there's somebody willing to provide it, they will get it. And that's the case with prohibition of liquor, and that's the case with marijuana today.
But it's interesting, and it'll be interesting to see how the Justice Department deals with these two states. I know in California, the Justice Department has shut down something like 600 dispensaries in California.
That's right, and these are legal dispensaries.
Exactly.
So there's a conflict between the federal law and the state law. But I think at some point it's going to be like the boy who's trying to put too many fingers into too many dikes around the country, if you have it in many, many states. I can't believe that the Justice Department is going to have this as one of their priorities going forward, as we see electoral majorities voting for legalization.
It's interesting. As I was preparing for this interview, I was thinking about how states have lotteries, which, of course, is gambling.
Mm-hmm.
States, including this one, very involved in casinos and licensing casinos. That states more, and maybe the federal government, more figuring out other ways of getting tax revenue.
It's revenue. It's revenue. And, you know, prohibition came to an end not because people didn't like it, although people didn't like it, not because it didn't work, even though it didn't work. It came to an end because the Depression arrived, and suddenly tax revenues plummeted, and people remembered, where did we get tax money before Prohibition, before the income tax came in 1913? We got them from the excise tax on alcohol, and we're in exactly the same place today. Where are we going to get these dollars?
Well, you write that in 1910, the federal government was getting 70% of its revenue from liquor sales.
Of its domestic revenue.
Domestic revenue.
From liquor sales. And you could not have prohibition until there was a substitute for that. So the prohibitionists somewhat surreptitiously supported the movement for an income tax. Mm-hmm. The 16th Amendment is ratified in 1913. The first income tax comes in, and within days of the Congress passing the first income tax, the Anti-Saloon League, the leading prohibitionist organization, said, now we can get a constitutional amendment because we have a substitute for the money.
You write about a guy named Wayne Wheeler, and he's someone we should know because his fingerprints are all over prohibition.
And all over our culture today in some ways. And Wheeler is a totally forgotten figure. During the late teens of the 1920s, he was as well known as any political figure who wasn't in elective office in the country. He was the equivalent of Karl Rove, I guess the Karl Rove before he got beaten up in the last election. He was the equivalent of Karl Rove and Grover Norquist of the Americans for Tax Reform. He was the legislative genius who planned the prohibition electoral movement and lobbied Congress for it and made it happen.
Yeah, and how did he do that?
Well,
it was complicated.
The simplest way of putting it is by manipulating majorities by the clever use of minorities, which is to say, in a specific legislative district, if, say, 46% of the people were for the Democrat and 44% were for the Republican, but he had 10% who would do whatever he said, ask them to do, if he had 10% who would vote for the dry candidate, he would endorse that dry candidate. And he did it in both parties, and it enabled him to put together not just majorities in Congress, but a two-thirds majority in both the House and the Senate.
So where did he get this power? I mean, is it like Grover Norquist?
It was organization. It began in the churches. It was a movement that came out of the Methodist and Baptist churches in the 1890s. The Anti-Saloon League, his organization, called itself the Church in Action Against the Saloon. They were an organization, said its founder, that was created to exact political retribution on its enemies. And they first amassed the support through the churches, and then they identified their enemies, which is to say the people who were in elective office who would not vote to outlaw liquor.
In fact, kept his eye on a president, on Congress. I mean, it was his job to shepherd this thing through and then enforce it, I guess.
The New York World said that Wayne Wheeler was the legislative bully in front of whom the U.S. Senate sits up and begs. He used to sit in the gallery of the House or the Senate when there was a debate or a vote going on involving any prohibition-related issue, and people would look up to him as if he were a Roman consul in the Colosseum determining whether the gladiator was going to survive or the lion was going to survive. And he would give them a thumbs up or a thumbs down, telling them how to vote, and on the basis of that, laws were made.
Your description of Carrie Nation, it goes like this. I was 6 feet tall, with the biceps of a stevedore, the face of a prison warden, and the persistence of a toothache.
Yeah, she was something else. And Carrie was more interesting than influential. We remember Carrie Nation, whose the results of her activities were rather inconsequential. We don't remember Wayne Wheeler, whose activities were phenomenally consequential. But Carrie, She got great press, and she knew how to get it. She was this very large woman who carried a hatchet in her hand and walked into bars in Kansas and just ripped them apart. She just smashed the mirrors, the cash registers. She cut open the tubes that were leading from the beer kegs to the taps. Her actual hatchet is on display across the street here at the National Constitution Center in the show American Spirits.
But one thing you say, and it should be acknowledged, that looking at colonial America, looking at the early century or so of America, we were a drinking country.
I would say we were a drunken country.
A drunken country.
That it goes back really to the origins of the Republic and before. You know, George Washington ordered that the members of the Continental Army, the soldiers in the Continental Army, were all entitled to 4 ounces of liquor a day as a ration. And this goes back to 1775, and that continues until the 1830s. By 1810, liquor was cheaper than tea in this country. There was so much of it around. By 1830, that was the moment when Americans drank more than they ever have had before or have ever since. The average American adult drank 7.3 gallons of pure alcohol a year, which is the equivalent of 90-fifths of 80-proof liquor.
So the 90-fifths.
The average American was drinking 1.8 bottles of liquor a week. And if you consider some people didn't drink at all, those who were drinking were really, really drinking.
And how did we get anything done under those
inebriated circumstances? Well, not a lot. Not a lot. And it led to a lot of social problems, as you can imagine, particularly family problems. The saloon of the 19th century was a male-only institution. And men would go to the saloon, they'd get hammered, and they would spend the mortgage money. They would lose more money gambling. They would come home in a state of inebriation and beat up the wife and children. They would lose their jobs because they would be hungover and couldn't get back to work. They would bring home what was known in the era as the syphilis of the innocent, which is to say that there were brothels attached to the saloons. They would contract venereal disease and then come home and infect their wives. It was an awful, awful problem. So there was a reason for the impulse toward prohibition. Not that it was the right solution, but there was a reason for it.
And that giving rise to the temperance movement. Obviously, a lot of women who were home being abused or
right.
and, having to figure out how to support their family.
You know, the women's suffrage movement comes out of the temperance movement, and the two of them moved together through the 19th and early 20th century as if they were identical twins. Susan B. Anthony began her career in public life as a temperance worker. She was against alcohol. School teacher from upstate New York. She goes to a convention of the New York State Sons of Temperance. She rises to speak, and the chairman says, "I'm sorry, the sisters are here to listen and learn, not to speak." And this happens to her again a year later in New York City, and she then decides that she can't do anything. She and her sisters can't do anything about the alcohol problem until they get the right to vote. So the motivation to get the vote for women came out of the detestation of the alcohol that was destroying family life in America.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Daniel Okrent is our guest today on Radio Times. He's the author of a book. It's now out in paperback called Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. He's also the curator of an exhibition that's across the street at the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia. It's called American Spirits, and it runs through April 2013. Daniel Okrent was the first public editor. Is that what you were?
Mm-hmm.
The first public editor of the New York Times. He's also the author of several other books, and he's a former book and magazine editor. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions or comments, give us a call. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Tate Weller, Certified Public Accountant, celebrates 90 years of specialized audit, tax, and advisory services to national and global nonprofit and financial services clients. TAITWeller.com. Tate Weller. Focus. Expertise. Results.
The doctoral program in educational leadership and professional studies at Holy Family University supports WHYY and will hold an information session on Wednesday, November 28th at 5:30 p.m. in the Education and Technology Center of Holy Family's Northeast Philadelphia campus. Holy Family's doctoral program seeks to develop effective and ethical leaders for schools and communities. More information via email. Email address is gradstudy@holyfamily.edu.
I'm Jesse Thorne. The writer Fran Lebowitz basically doesn't feel stage fright.
I have no anxiety about it at all. I have actually fallen asleep in the Letterman green room.
She's pretty much fearless, except for in one important area.
I have only one fear, and that is of writing.
Fran Lebowitz, this week on Bullseye from PRI.
tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the University of Southern California, announcing the USC Gloria Kaufman School of Dance, the new home for contemporary and classical dance, built with a transformative gift from Gloria Kaufman. More at kaufman.usc.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, Daniel Okrent is our guest, and we're talking about some of the striking and interesting parallels between prohibition and the current war on drugs. He's the author of a book called Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. It's now out in paperback, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You talked about the saloons and a lot of the connection, I guess, between the immigrants that were coming into the country in the 19th century and the development of saloons.
Right. Around 1845, 1850, American drinking habits change. We go from a whiskey drinking country to a beer drinking country. This is because of the immigration in the 1840s of the Germans and the Irish. They also build the American brewing industry, particularly the Germans do. And from the 1860 until 1900, our per capita consumption of beer increased 33-fold in this country. And the saloons serving the beer, they became community centers. They were hiring halls in the immigrant ghettos of the big cities of the East. They were the place in the lumber camps and the mining camps in of the West where you would get your mail, where you'd go to meet somebody. They were obviously the site for brothels as well. They were critically wound into the lives of the working people, the immigrant working people of the 19th century. And they were also very clever marketers, the people who ran the beer industry. They made arrangements with saloons. They created what was called the Tied House System, T-I-E-D, where any given saloon would sell only one particular brand of beer. In exchange for that, the brewery that, well, you know, be it Anheuser-Busch or Pabst or whomever, would provide everything you needed to operate your saloon, the glassware, the cutlery, the food for that thing that we said doesn't exist, the free lunch. They gave them the free lunch. What did the free lunch consist of? Saltines, clams, sardines, anything, sausages, salty. To make you drink more beer. See, there is no such thing as a free lunch. You have to pay for the beer to go with it.
That's called good marketing.
Exactly.
Yes? Well, you describe there were 100,000 saloons, I guess, by in the mid-19th century. By the end of the 19th century, 300,000.
Yeah. There are blocks in the Lower East Side of New York that might have 60 storefronts. 10 of them would have been saloons. It's just that they were everywhere. Jacob Riest did a survey of the area south of 14th Street in New York, counting the number of saloons relative to the number of churches. The answer was exactly what you would expect, a lot more saloons and a lot more people in them, and they were there on Sunday mornings as well.
Well, as you have said, and actually as you write in your book, it is kind of crazy to think that here's this drinking country passes this constitutional amendment, the 18th Amendment, to make the distribution and sale of alcohol illegal.
It's shocking. You think that, you know, for 150 years, Americans had been drinking freely, and then suddenly they couldn't legally buy a glass of beer. It shows not just the manipulation of and I say it was the democratic manipulation of a democratic system by Wayne Wheeler and the Anti-Saloon League, but the other factors that come into play. For instance, we were talking about women's suffrage. The people who fought women's suffrage in every state on a state-by-state basis were the breweries, because they knew that if women got the vote, they would be their biggest opponents and might bring about changes in the liquor laws. Well, the consequence was that as women got the vote on a state-by-state basis, and there were 23 states that had female suffrage before the 19th Amendment was enacted, in each of those states, the first thing they did was vote to close the saloons, because it was the breweries who had been fighting against them. Second thing was the tax movement. You know, who would relate income tax to alcohol? But as I said before, until you had an income tax, you couldn't get rid of alcohol. So there was a mutual support. And then finally, World War I, because all the brewers, what were their last names?
You know, they were German.
They were Schmidt and Ortlieb and Yingling, and to keep it local, and Schlitz and Pabst and Busch and Anheuser to go national with it. They were all German, and they were pointed to by Wayne Wheeler and the Anti-Saloon League as enemies of the American war effort. Mm-hmm. And that's what put it over the top.
And how quickly, once the sale and it wasn't the drinking of liquor that was illegal. Yeah. It was the sale and distribution.
Yeah, sale, distribution, and manufacturing. The drinking was never made illegal under the federal law. That was because Wheeler, who helped draft the Volstead Act, the enforcement law, he reasoned that if drinking were illegal, no one would ever testify against his supplier. because then he'd be implicating himself and would also be subject to arrest and criminal action. So drinking always remained legal. It was the supplier. And what we see in the movies and what Hollywood has given us of people coming in, the agents coming in and conducting a raid and arresting the patrons, that never happened. They arrested the waiters, they arrested the bartenders, the owner if he was present. But the patrons, not until 1930 were the patrons beginning to be arrested, and even then it was legally questionable.
In fact, I'm not sure whether you write or you're quoting someone in this book saying that if you were in a speakeasy and the feds came in, you just sat. The best thing to do was not to run, but to sit quietly at your table.
Sit quietly while they confiscated the liquor, usually which the feds would confiscate the liquor, and then, of course, they would use it themselves or sell it themselves. Enormous corruption, spectacular corruption. And then, when they were gone, somebody would bring out another supply.
And we're talking about corruption at just about every level. Police, politicians.
The judicial system. Philadelphia was as corrupt a city as existed in the country. In 1928, there was a huge investigation of the police department and terrible, terrible, terrible corruption from the lowest level to sergeants and lieutenants who were making $150,000 a year, who had bank accounts with hundreds of thousands of dollars in it, even though their salary was $3,000 a year.
And how quickly did organized crime get involved, and did it become the kind of violence that we associate with Prohibition?
Organized crime had always existed before, but it was localized until Prohibition. In any given city, there would be a tenderloin area, a red light district where there was gambling and prostitution and maybe drugs and illegal liquor. But not until Prohibition, when you had huge quantities of physical goods that need to be shipped from one place to another, did you need to create a national physical criminal syndicate so that things could be moved from one place. The hub of that was here in Philadelphia. The first meeting of the National Criminal Syndicate was in Atlantic City in 1929. One of the reasons why it was based here was because there was so much industrial alcohol being legally produced under license from the government in the chemical industry in the Delaware Valley. And then the federal agent would come in if you had produced 10,000 gallons of alcohol to make aftershave out of it or whatever, and he'd put in an emetic or something that would make it taste terrible or smell terrible. He'd leave. He'd sign your permit. You could take it out. And then if you were Boo Boo Hoff, the head of the Quaker Alcohol Company, which was and the Chestnut Street Gang, you would bring in your chemist to renature the alcohol, and then you would flavor it if you wanted to make it taste like scotch. You would add creosote. You would color it with any number of substances and then pour it into bottles and ship it off to Kansas City to your allies in organized crime. And that's the syndicate. By 1932, there were 21 cities involved in the syndicate. They divided up the country. They determined areas of influence, who had which markets, they fixed prices. That scene in The Godfather when they're sitting around the table making the rules, that was genuine.
Wow. And I can only imagine what that must have tasted like, thinking about all the chemicals that were added and then subtracted.
It shows you how much people wanted to get drunk. And it also shows why certain drinks became popular. Gin was very easy to make from neutral spirits without doing much. You'd add glycerin to give it a bead and some juniper berries, and you had gin. It was much harder to get any quality imported goods, although the closer you lived to the East Coast, it was possible to get imported goods that were usually shipped up to from the Bahamas or down from the French islands of Saint-Pierre and Miquelon in the North Atlantic.
You write, in New England, that liquor came from ships anchored beyond the three-mile limit. You mentioned Philadelphia using the chemical industry of the Delaware Valley. The Chicagoans depended on the resources, if murderous, of the Jenna brothers. Denver, it seemed, as you said, all these interconnected cities, and it looked like Detroit was the real
drinking
Detroit capital.
Was sitting right there on the Canadian border, and it was very easy to get legal Canadian liquor shipped into the United States and from Detroit spread throughout the upper Midwest. Mm-hmm. The Purple Gang was probably as murderous a criminal group in the country. Dominated Detroit and had alliances with Capone's gang in Chicago, and Indianapolis, Milwaukee, various other places. Mm-hmm. The Canadian border was extremely porous. The commissioner of Prohibition said you can't keep a liquid from dripping through a dotted line, and it dripped through for 13 years.
And that's Daniel Okrent, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about Prohibition. He wrote a book about it a couple of years ago, now out in paperback, called Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. exhibition. He's also the curator of an exhibition at the National Constitution Center, which is here in Philadelphia. It's called American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition, and it runs through April 2013. And we are talking about prohibition. We also began with a conversation about a very interesting op-ed that Daniel Okrent wrote about the fact that two states have legalized marijuana for recreational use and what that says or doesn't say about the prohibition of drugs in this country. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You also talk about the kind of slang and words that grew up around prohibition, the kind of lingo, I guess, and maybe even code language that was used for people to buy and sell or even drink liquor.
Well, whenever you're doing something illegal, you kind of develop there are social habits and language that come out of it. My favorite creation of language was actually a newspaper competition. The Boston Herald in 1922 had a competition to come up with a word to describe those Americans who were violating the Volstead Act, the prohibition law, on a regular basis, just pretending it didn't exist. And out of that came scoff law, which has been with us for 90 years since. Taken for a ride. That was a criminal term that was a euphemism for being taken somewhere in a car, shot, and then dropped off in the countryside. Wow. and abandoned. Other social habits that changed. You know, men and women never used to drink together in public in this country until prohibition. During the saloon era, the saloons were male only, and then suddenly something is against the law, then tradition changes, and you can be a little sporting, and what's that like, and women start showing up in the speakeasies, and everything changes then, because if you have women and men together in a place...
Drinking,
you've got to have music, and if you have music, that music is jazz. That's how jazz spreads. There's dancing, the spread of the Charleston and similar dances. The invention of the American nightclub and the cabaret, it comes out of prohibition. Men and women in the evening drinking together with music present.
And could you say that a kind of feminism grew out of that as well?
Yes, it was liberating, clearly. I think that we do make a mistake to think that the Roaring Twenties roared strictly because of Prohibition. I think a lot of it had to do with the reaction to World War I, that the young people of that era, coming out of the horrible carnage of World War I, everything had changed in their world, and there was a level of kind of let's enjoy our lives while we can, because we see the same thing happening in Great Britain that was happening here in the U.S., and there were no Prohibition laws in Great Britain. But the women stepping into the speakeasy, addressing now in shorter skirts and different profile, sexual activity increasing, the ability to talk about sex in public, that really begins in the 1920s. And these things all very much relate to one another in that era.
But what's also interesting, because of course this was an impossible law to stick, was that there were all sorts of exceptions, including sacramental liquor used for religious services, for
right?
Instance.
Jews and Catholics were almost universally opposed to prohibition for cultural reasons as well as religious reasons. And in an effort to sort of mollify them, there was an exception put into the Volstead Act that made it possible to acquire and to drink. Sacramental beverages. It was meant to be wine, obviously, in the beginning. Well, it changes somewhat. In the Catholic Church, by 1921, Georges de la Tour of the Beaulieu Vineyard in California, who has a license from the Catholic Church to continue to make altar wines, is offering his altar wines in 11 different grape varietals. You can get Riesling, Tokay, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, and so on and so forth, which is
for religious
services. Among Jews, it was a little bit different. Any rabbi was licensed to be able to give any member of a congregation a permit that would enable him to get 10 gallons a year of wine for the Sabbath and holiday services. But who was to say who was a rabbi? And there became this huge business of people pretending to be rabbis, claiming congregations, signing up membership by taking names out of the obituary columns in the newspapers, and then really leading to a great scandal that culminated in 1925 with the arrest of a couple of big-time rabbis in New York named McGuire and Houlihan. suddenly there was a little bit of a crackdown on that business.
And I guess if you weren't feeling well, you could go to your doctor. If you had some quote-unquote female complaints, and they might prescribe something like Sam Thompson's Old Monongahela Pure Rye Whiskey.
Right. That was always helpful for them. but you could buy 1924. You could get Old Forester or Jim Beam for medicinal purposes only. You would go to your physician for the price in the big city was about $3 a prescription. Every 10 days, you could get a prescription and you could get a pint of whiskey. You would take that down to your drugstore. They'd give you a bottle of whiskey, and you'd go home and you'd take care of your female problems, your male problems, or any other problem you had. You know, the American Medical Association, which had been against the medical use of alcohol, came out in 1922 with a report having surveyed its membership that there were 27 different illnesses that should be and could be treated by alcohol. And these range from cancer and diabetes to snake bite and dyspepsia to my very favorite, old age.
I believe in that one. Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. It looks like we have Chris from Lower Merion joining us on Radio Times. And Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
My grandfather was in the Coast Guard, stationed on the Jersey Shore during Prohibition. And according to family lore, he was a rum runner. And he used his position there to further those that end. And my question to you is, did when you were doing your research, did you come across anything about the Coast Guard and its involvement one way or another with how alcohol sort of showed up at our shores?
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, go ahead.
And your family's story is more than likely accurate. Most families say, well, maybe there was corruption, but my family wasn't involved in it. There were various ways to get really, really rich in the 1920s. One was to be a federal member, an agent of the Bureau of Prohibition, or to be an officer in the Coast Guard. Mm-hmm. The opportunity for bribery, the opportunity to either take goods yourself and move it around as a rum runner, or simply to take money from rum runners so that you didn't arrest them, that you didn't intervene in their activity, was enormous. When a job opened up for a prohibition agent, which paid the modern equivalent of about $22,000 a year, there would be hundreds of applicants, and these people could become very, very wealthy men and women as a result. I hope the caller's family did. If they were going to be corrupt, I hope they made a lot of money.
They made a lot of money. Chris, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Wasn't the Kennedy family involved in
In fact, no.
The
last six pages of my book, before you get to the epilogue, are the story of Joe Kennedy. And you can't prove a negative, but I think I come to 99.44% surety of proving not only was he not a bootlegger, but why we believed that he was. It's a rather complex story, but put, shortly after Prohibition, he got into the liquor distribution business, and he had brought the liquor in legally under bond, knowing that Prohibition was coming to an end, in October of 1933, before the December arrival of repeal. 20 years later, when his son is getting involved in national politics, there are stories about the family and where they make their money, and a writer in the Chicago Tribune wrote in 1954 that he was importing liquor. He imported liquor from the UK during Prohibition, which was true, but it didn't say it was legal, and it was in the last 2 months of Prohibition, and the story began to spread from there. Joe Kennedy was had to be approved by the Senate for three different federal positions during the 1930s, and it never came up in any of the hearings, never in any of the dry publications. It's just an interesting piece of mythology.
Indeed it is. Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Daniel Okrent is our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about Prohibition, something that he wrote about in a book called Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition, now out in paperback. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
JerseyArts.com supports WHYY, featuring details on Grounds for Sculpture, the 42-acre sculpture park in Hamilton Township, New Jersey, near Princeton. Offering 3 months of winter wonders, including thousands of holiday lights in its trees, family fun, and seasonal festivities starting with the annual Lights On Celebration November 24th and 25th. Open late Fridays and Saturdays in December. Directions and a calendar of events at groundsforsculpture.org. Grounds for Sculpture and more online at jerseyarts.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Historian Doris Kearns Goodwin and retired Army Colonel Andrew Bacevich weigh in on the rise and fall of David Petraeus and what today's leaders can learn from Lincoln. Also, resident chef Kathy Gunst on how to time your Thanksgiving meal. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Are you a breast cancer survivor? Do you have hot flashes? The Integrative Medicine Program at Penn Medicine is studying ways to improve the quality of life of breast cancer survivors. You may be eligible to participate in a research study looking at the effects of acupuncture or medication to treat hot flashes. Initial evaluations determine eligibility. To learn more about Penn's Integrative Medicine Program, 215-349-5647. 215-349-5647.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Daniel Okrent. He writes in the epilogue to his book, Last Call, that Prohibition was a failure on just about every front except for one. Americans drank a lot less alcohol during those 13 years. Okrent also wrote an interesting op-ed about some of the parallels between Prohibition and the current war on drugs. He's a former book and magazine editor, the first public editor of the New York Times, the author of several books, including Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. What's so interesting in hearing you talk about Prohibition is all the hypocrisy associated with that amendment and the inability of the country really to prevent people from drinking.
Well, there was an odd thing going on, almost as if it was enough for the prohibitionists to have the law in place. That was more important to them, to have the symbolism of the law than the actual effect of the law. One of the great conflicts that occurred during the 20s, the same Congresses that put in place these very strict anti-drinking laws were the same Congresses that didn't want to spend money on anything at all. So they didn't appropriate sufficient money to enforce it. Congressman Fiorello LaGuardia, later the mayor of New York, was the leader of the Wetzel Congress. And each year he would introduce a measure to increase the federal appropriation for enforcement a hundredfold, from $2.5 million to $250 million, forcing the prohibitionists to vote against enforcement and to show how hypocritical they were.
Yeah. When you look at prohibition, and again, something that you write, eight decades of movies, television shows have showed this kind of glamorous part of prohibition. You say two elements are missing from this picture: pain and desperation.
Well, there was an awful lot of violence, obviously caused by the criminal activity, but additionally, there was a lot of really bad liquor out there, fouled liquor, and people. Bad batches would kill people by the score. New Year's Eve 1926, 55 people died in New York from a bad batch of industrial liquor that had been altered. It led to all sorts of social upheavals as well that couldn't be looked at in a positive way at all. It led to unemployment in some, the beer and distilling industries as a combined industry was fifth largest industry in the U.S. in 1920 when Prohibition came in. Those were tens of thousands of people thrown out of work. So there was much that was not very pleasant about it.
But as you said earlier, it was really the Depression and the government's need for money that brought around the
right.
end of Prohibition.
Yeah, I mean, the much of the country had turned against Prohibition. Well, first of all, I don't think there was ever a majority in support of it.
Right.
But then even those who had supported, many had turned against it by 1928, 1929. When the stock market crashes in 1929 and federal tax collections plummet because people don't have incomes, how are they going to have income taxes? There was this desperate need for two things. One was to bring back the alcohol because of the taxes on alcohol. And in the very first year post-repeal, 9% of all federal revenue, domestic and tariff revenue, came from the tax on alcohol, 9% in the very first year that it was back. But secondarily, it was a jobs program. It put, at a time when unemployment reached 26% in this country, to suddenly bring back not just the breweries and the distilleries, but the truck drivers, the ice makers, the barrel makers, so many, the people in the cork industry, who knew there was such a thing. Suddenly there were tens of thousands of people put back to work.
Let me get back to our callers. We have John from Cherry Hill joining us today on Radio Times. And John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I was wondering, where were the voices of reason as Prohibition approached was there anyone predicting that there'd be this massive violence and criminal activity and social upheaval with Prohibition? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Sean. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, there were several people, but the one who's most interesting to me was William Howard Taft, the ex-president, who during the 1910s, as the Prohibition movement was rising, was teaching at the Yale Law School, and he said exactly that. He predicted everything that was going to happen. Of course, by the time Prohibition arrived, he's become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and interestingly, he is in the block that votes repeatedly to uphold the enforcement of the Prohibition laws, even though he had predicted precisely those that law-breaking that he was now I guess it makes sense that he would try to stop it at that point.
But as you say, and as what happened after the repeal, there was just much more government regulation of drinking. There were age limitations. Here in Pennsylvania, we have the vestiges of Prohibition.
More in Pennsylvania than almost anywhere.
With our state stores.
This is the great irony of Prohibition. It was much easier to get a drink in Philadelphia during Prohibition than after Prohibition. If you were a 14-year-old walking down Chestnut Street at 3 in the morning on a Sunday morning, Saturday night, Sunday morning, you wanted a drink, you could walk in and you could get it in 20 different places. When there is no liquor legally allowed, there are no laws controlling liquor. So all the saloon owners are paying bribes to the local police and to the federal agents, and the taps are flowing all day long. 1933 comes around, repeal, and the governor of Pennsylvania at the time, Gifford Pinchot, was very much an ardent dry, and he put in the system that you've been living with ever since. Actually, it's gotten somewhat better, but blue laws. You can't sell on Sundays. There are closing hours. There are age limits. You can't be near a church. You can't be near a school. You can only buy liquor from a state store. This is an absolute control of the liquor business, and as a result, it did become harder to drink than it was before, and we didn't get back to our pre-prohibition drinking levels until the 1970s.
Wow. And what are those levels today? Do you know?
Not as high as they were in the 1830s, I'm happy to say. It's about four gallons of alcohol a year, which is about 40 bottles of liquor per person per year.
Let me go back to the piece that you wrote after the two states voted to legalize recreational marijuana. You say, the short answer, tax, regulate, and legalize. What we're doing now isn't working, and it's costing us an awful lot. Some of the parallels between our current war on drugs and prohibition.
Well, one, it isn't working. Two, it's not anybody who wants marijuana has no problem getting it, as all of us who have ever had teenage children know. Or all of us who have ever been teenagers, I guess, know if you're not quite as old as I am. Secondarily, criminal activity. It does nothing but enrich criminals and creates violence. Now it's happening mostly in Mexico. That is all the drug industry, drugs being sold into the United States, that is creating that horrible, horrible violence and political corruption and that's devastating Mexico and is depriving the government of tax revenue. There's also the risk of substandard product, as during Prohibition, the poisonous liquor. I think that there are probably many instances of people selling drugs that aren't as pure as they might be. Regulation would change all that. And as I say, I'm not an advocate for marijuana. I'm an advocate for sensible government. And I think that if we really want to control this issue and police it better, that legalization is the way to do it. Another way of looking at it is drunken driving. In many states, driving while stoned isn't against the law because stoned isn't acknowledged by the law. What certainly isn't the case is that the police cars everywhere carry breathalyzers.
Yes.
They tell you what the alcohol level of your blood is, but they don't carry THC analyzers. They would if it were legal.
And it's not to say that marijuana is risk-free, obviously.
For some
people who abuse this drug, they're going to run into problems.
It's identical to alcohol in that sense. Alcohol can be really, really bad, and it's ruined many, many lives, and it's caused many, many deaths. But the solution to that is not to make it illegal. It's to educate people and to control it.
Let me get Matt from Kennett Square to join our conversation. And, Matt, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
My question is just about why... Why does the guest believe that could you give me some insight about why it's taken so long? Why has the drug war lasted so long when it's been decades since I think it's been pretty obvious to most people that it's so destructive and so unsuccessful.
That's a good question, Ahmed. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think it comes down to this, that at the federal level, for a president to say, I'm going to stop the war on drugs, he just couldn't do that. We have to be against drugs, that there's not an understanding of what that what it means to be against the spread of drugs. You know, in California, 2010, ballot measure, not a single elected official in California came out for legalization of marijuana. Hmm. There's no industrial constituency for it. There's no money constituency for it. And only recently is there a popular constituency, and that's what we saw in Colorado and Washington. You know, and just since Election Day, 2 weeks ago, or not even 2 weeks ago, measures have been introduced into the legislatures of Rhode Island and Maine to legalize, and I think it's going to spread because now there is a constituency to bring some sense to our drug laws.
And do you think part of that constituency are people that have supported medical marijuana, that at least opened the door a crack to recreational?
Yeah, look, there were two groups that were against prohibition. There were for prohibition, it was said, Baptists and bootleggers. And now the people who are for marijuana prohibition are those people who believe that it would be dangerous to allow marijuana to spread or to be legalized, and the marijuana growers and the criminals. They're really for marijuana prohibition. Medical marijuana was a wedge. We saw in many states medical marijuana coming in, and somehow we still managed to function as a civil society.
Let me get, looks like Daniel from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Daniel, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Marty. My original question was if your guest was familiar with Boardwalk Empire and if he could comment on its authenticity or historical accuracy. But then what he just said about the marijuana laws, don't you think it's also because the children of the 60s are now in their 50s or 60s themselves and making the law changes?
Well, that's an interesting comment, Daniel.
In fact, being in my 60s myself, I didn't do anything to change these laws, and I don't know how many of us did. It's our children who are the ones who are changing the laws. That's what's changed now. It's our children and even younger people. I think it's with so many social issues, young voters between 18 and 30 have a very different view of the way the world ought to operate.
This and many other issues.
Exactly, and I think that they're related in that sense. Boardwalk Empire, yeah, it's very accurate. There are storylines that have been invented, but the nature of the political, the connection between the politically corrupt establishment and the criminal establishment, that's extremely well done, well explained. I really compliment them on the show.
Going back to a theme that you've touched on several times, which is just the fact that government needs revenue. I'm thinking about all the costs to run our prison system and a large percentage of people in prison for nonviolent drug-related crimes. And I think a lot of states are trying to figure out how do you pay the bills? How do you balance the budget when you've got so many people in prison for these kinds of crimes?
Yeah, I think those laws are changing. That's about to change in New York State, the Rockefeller-era drug laws that have really ballooned the prison system. This is similar to Prohibition. Federal prison system in the 1920s, there were two federal prisons until Prohibition came along, and then they had to suddenly build a prison system to accommodate all the offenders who were arrested and convicted. The money that we spend on interdiction at the borders and the amount of money and time that is spent by local police departments, it adds up to, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe even billions of dollars. One of the most effective organizations arguing for the change in the marijuana laws is an organization called LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And it's police commissioners, judges, prosecutors. They realize it's insane. I spoke to the top management of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms when my book came out 2 years ago, and one of them asked me, you know, what do you think of the current drug laws and whether they're working? I said, I hate to say this to you guys, but they're not working. And he said, we don't think so either. And these are the people who are charged with enforcing.
Let me get, it looks like Michael, let me get Anders from South Philadelphia. Anders, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Hi. My question is, usually we associate revolutionary acts with a demographic shift, such as, you know, a youth bulge or something like that. And my question is regarding whether or not there was a demographic shift in the voting which resulted in prohibition, and if so, what was that?
Oh, interesting.
There really wasn't a demographic shift. The one thing that did happen that is interesting along those lines is that beginning around 1885, 1888, through the influence of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, there were put into place in nearly every school district in the country a health program that required in the curriculum to talk about the evils of alcohol, and it was called scientific temperance instruction. It was not scientific. It was all mythology, and it wasn't instruction. It was indoctrination. But that was the generation of school kids who 20 years later voted for the congressman who put prohibition into the Constitution.
I hear some parallels there, Rob. Anders, thanks for the call. Let me squeeze Michael from North Philadelphia on. And Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Two comments. One, the book is great, and I love your sense of humor in the book.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Regarding the drug laws and prohibition, I'd be curious on what if in fact the drug laws today, as it relates to the use of drugs being viewed as an African American phenomenon, is similar to the perception of the use of alcohol being viewed as something that impacted the new immigrants.
Sure.
At the turn of the century, and the relationship of those two issues.
Michael, thanks for the
call.
Well,
not just new immigrants, but also African Americans, particularly in the South. Obviously, the support for prohibition was seen as a way of keeping alcohol out of the hands of the African American population. There was nothing. The imagery that the Southern prohibitionists used was this: to them and to the racist South of the time, the terrifying image of a black man with a bottle in one hand and a ballot in the other hand, and just as the Jim Crow laws came in to take away the ballot, so the prohibition laws were coming in to take away that bottle. It was used very effectively. And similarly with the immigrants. That was the KKK's involvement. The KKK, that era, was much more of an anti-immigrant organization than an anti-black organization. Blacks had no rights, but they wanted to keep the immigrants from having rights as well, and they used prohibition as their rallying banner.
And we're almost out of time here, and not to say it's just for African-American communities, but when you look at poor communities and you look at our drug laws, it seems that's where this war is being waged.
Yeah, it seems to be. I mean, certainly if you look at the color of those who are imprisoned, it has hardly been representative of the American demographic.
Are you working on another book?
No, I'm not. A book like this one takes a very long time, and I'm old and tired. But, I may someday.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And our guest has been Daniel Okrent, and the book is called Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. He's also the curator of an exhibition at the National Constitution Center across the street from us here at WHYY in Philadelphia, and the exhibit called American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. Go to WHYY.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program, including some pictures on our Facebook page. You can see what Daniel Okrent looks like. I'm Marty Moscoyne. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour radio time. Stay with us. We'll be right back.